From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the latest leaks from whistleblower Edward Snowden reveal the NSA's plans to exploit suspected Muslim radicals by revealing their explicit online activities.
The documents are very clear that none of these individuals have any serious ties to terrorism at all.
Also today, the struggle for restaurant servers and other tipped workers to see their minimum wage increased. We're in Greece after a World Health Organization report wrongly suggested Greeks are deliberately infecting themselves with the HIV virus. And we're in the British capital, where street art is being used to fight poverty.
I'd climb buildings late at night and sort of stick them on top of these buildings. My initial idea was for people to wake up one morning and go to work and then just see all these mushrooms sprouting about the street.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Former Prime Minister of Italy Silvio Berlusconi has been expelled from Parliament by Italy's Senate. Berlusconi had been a mainstay in Italian politics for two decades, but a conviction for tax fraud may have ended his long run. Meanwhile, Latvia's Prime Minister Valdis Dombrovskis has resigned his post following a deadly collapse at a supermarket in Riga. The ex-PM said that the disaster, which left at least 54 people dead, showed that new leadership was needed in Latvia. America's Vice President Joe Biden will be headed to China, Japan, and South Korea next week in an effort to ease tensions in the region. This weekend, China claimed an air defense identification zone over some disputed islands in the East China Sea, insisting that aircraft in the area obey its rules. Lorna Shattuck has more.
The islands, called the Senkaku in Japan and Diaoyu in China, have been a source of tension between the two Asian powers for decades. China's new air zone overlaps with one already set out by Japan and includes the islands, which are controlled by Tokyo. Joe Biden's trip to Asia had already been planned, but takes on new significance as a week-long diplomatic mission to convey American concerns that tensions over the air zone could easily flare up.
According to a report in the Washington Post, Microsoft will be undertaking major new efforts to encrypt its internet traffic. These efforts are reportedly a result of fears that the National Security Agency may have broken into Microsoft's global communication links. Rachel Silverman has the details.
According to the Washington Post report, Microsoft executives are meeting this week to decide exactly what encryption initiatives to deploy and how quickly to deploy them. The report says Microsoft's suspicions that the NSA may have broken into its global communications links became deeper last month after reports that the NSA was intercepting traffic inside the networks of industry rivals Google and Yahoo. According to the Post, documents made available by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden suggest, but don't prove, the company has cause for concern.
The White House has called on Iran to return ex-FBI agent Robert Levinson, who U.S. authorities believe is being held captive in the country. Mr. Levinson went missing during a business trip on the Iranian island of Kish in March 2007. Kate Fisher reports.
The request comes just days after a deal was reached between Iran and Western powers aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear program. In a statement, White House spokesman Jay Carney said that Mr. Levinson is now one of the longest-held Americans in history. He asked for Iran's assistance in securing his health, welfare and safe return. Though Mr. Levinson has appeared in images as a captive, Iran has always said it doesn't know anything about his disappearance or his whereabouts.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Months after the German elections, an agreement's been made in Berlin for the formation of a coalition government. A deal was agreed early Wednesday between Germany's Christian Democrats, led by Chancellor Angela Merkel, and the Social Democrats, who've made a number of political demands. Cuba has decided to indefinitely suspend its consular services in the U.S. Havana says this is because it has become impossible to access banking services in the U.S. as a result of the economic embargo. In a statement released by the Cuban government, officials said that everything but humanitarian services at the consulate have come to a halt. And in a new video to the U.S. Congress by Secretary of State John Kerry, the Obama administration is defending the deal reached with the P5 plus one countries and Iran on the country's nuclear ambitions. Lawmakers have been urging a fresh round of sanctions, skeptical that Iran will live up to its end of the bargain. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
The White House wants to make clear what the deal with Iran does and does not do. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry recorded a video message to the U.S. Congress.
It does not lift the current architecture of our sanctions. Our sanctions are basically banking and oil sanctions, and those sanctions will stay in place.
Secretary Kerry adds that if the deal with Iran falls apart, Tehran will quickly face even tougher sanctions. However, key American senators are vowing to reconcile Democratic and Republican proposals to increase the sanctions regime as soon as possible, despite the White House promise during the Geneva negotiations to put all sanctions legislation on hold for 6 months. And while there is open skepticism from lawmakers and experts about whether Iran will live up to its commitments, the Obama administration says ultimately it is up to Tehran to prove that its nuclear program is peaceful.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Exploiting the vulnerabilities of so-called Muslim radicals. That's the latest headline generated by leaked NSA documents. The files passed to the US media by whistleblower Edward Snowden suggest US intelligence plan to use electronic surveillance to undermine the credibility, authority, and reputation of several targets. It named six suspected foreign Muslim radicalizers, one of whom the report says could be vulnerable due to the sexually explicit nature of their online activity. While US intelligence officials have defended the practice as lawful, privacy groups say it's another example of unchecked NSA intrusion. Earlier, I spoke to Brett Max Kaufman from the American Civil Liberties Union.
Well, the story paints a picture of some documents obtained from Edward Snowden that show kind of discussions in the NSA about how to discredit certain individuals abroad who it calls radicals or radicalizers. And it seeks to do so by using surveillance that it has acquired about these individuals and kind of contemplating revealing embarrassing details about their online habits, including their use of pornography and other things like that. So that is that the main document released by Glenn Greenwald in his HuffPost story last night talks about kind of exposing the vulnerabilities of these radicalizers, and the goal of that, of course, would be to publicly undermine those individuals and decrease their influence.
And it was something that, in that same article, a national intelligence spokesperson said, you know, the reason why we're doing this is because the US naturally uses all lawful tools at its disposal to impede the efforts of valid terrorist targets. But there's some question over the validity of these targets.
Exactly. And the documents are very clear that none of these individuals have any serious ties to terrorism or radical activity at all. And so they're essentially painting a group of individuals who has influence in social media abroad in the Muslim world, and because they fear the influence of these individuals, they are undertaking this effort to undermine them publicly. Now, the documents don't give us any sense of whether any of these plans were acted upon. But the documents themselves make clear that none of these people are actually involved in terrorism, connected to terrorism. And it raises very serious and frightening questions about the use of this kind of surveillance for this kind of purpose. The article mentions it, but the United States has its own kind of sorry and sad history of law enforcement and our intelligence agencies doing precisely the same thing. Very famously, the FBI tapped the hotel rooms of Martin Luther King for years in order to find out salacious details about his private sex life in order to discredit him and his cause. And what the NSA is doing now, apparently, has some very disturbing echoes of that activity that we thought we had left behind.
And like many of the NSA revelations that have come courtesy of Edward Snowden, do you expect this to change anything in terms of the practices of the NSA and the American intelligence? Or will this form of surveillance simply continue unfettered?
I think it's impossible to know what the NSA has done with these discussions and this information, or what it will do. But the story is certainly an unwelcome reminder about what it means to give intelligence agencies this kind of unfettered access to the most sensitive personal information that individuals have. And in a world in which we spend such a great amount of our lives online, a world where the NSA has in storage a record of that life becomes very fertile ground for exactly the kind of efforts that have been revealed in this article.
Brett Max Kaufman for the American Civil Liberties Union. Staying in the Capitol, where President Obama has repeatedly called on Congress to raise the federal minimum wage, which has been stuck at $7.25 since 2007. Less often discussed is the wage for restaurant servers and other tipped workers, which hasn't risen above $2.13 for more than two decades. Now, several local and national campaigns are seeking to change that, saying a pay increase would help struggling workers and the economy. In Washington, Alice Olstein has more.
Naya Potts is a single mother and a full-time waitress in Washington, D.C. She works at an upscale pizzeria in a federal building, and as a federal subcontracted worker, she gets no overtime, no health care, and no sick days. As for her wages, it depends entirely on the generosity of her fickle customers.
This is the Center for International Trade Promotion. So we have a lot of people that come in from different countries. People from other countries whose workers are paid a living wage are not used to, you know, that worker's wage for the day, depending on them being conscious about the fact that these workers' wages depend on them. You get a lot of people who really appreciate your service. You give your 110% best to them, and they round up on the dollar for your tip. So your tip can literally be 67 cents, even though they've eaten $50 worth of food. That's a day ruiner there.
Though the federal tipped minimum wage hasn't increased since 1991, it varies drastically from state to state. In Alaska, Washington State, California, Nevada, Montana, and Minnesota, there's no difference between the minimum wage for tipped workers and everyone else. Teo Reyes, the research director for the Restaurant Opportunities Center, says the thriving restaurant scenes in some of those highest-paying states, such as Washington and California, disprove complaints from industry lobby groups that raising the federal wage would put them out of business.
And you would think that that would mean that the states that have that pay workers $2.13 would have stronger industries, because their argument is that they can't afford to pay more, whereas in fact the highest growing restaurants are in the states that have higher minimum wages as a rule. But like I said, there's variation nationwide.
In Washington, D.C., tipped workers earn $2.77 an hour. And with much of that withheld for taxes, Potts and other workers say it's common to get a paycheck of $0, making them entirely dependent on tips. Employers are required by law to compensate their workers if the tips they earn don't put them at least minimum wage. But Sonia Bacchus and other DC restaurant workers says this almost never happens, and putting the burden on workers to enforce the law makes them vulnerable to retaliation.
To have to go and chase your employer and say, give me what's mine, you know, is A, not going to do you any favors on the schedule, and then B, you know, it's just ridiculous that we should have to do that. There are powers in place that should be doing this, and there's just no enforcement.
Bacchus has been working as a server for the past 13 years, ever since graduating high school. She has seen little increase in her wages during that time, even as everything around her became more expensive.
Pretty much everybody knows that things don't cost what they cost 20 years ago. Rent in the city, rent anywhere around the city, is exponentially higher than it was 20 years ago. Transportation, gas, cars, cost of living, just period. And why tipped workers should be excluded for that makes absolutely no sense.
A bill introduced this year in Congress by Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin and California Democrat George Miller would raise the minimum wage to $10.10 by 2015 and raise the wage for jobs that rely on tips to 70% of the standard minimum wage. It would also tie both wages to the cost of living, so they would increase automatically each year. Baucus says this would help address the instability she and many other workers face on a regular basis.
You don't know how much you're going to walk out with any night that you work. Any day that you work, it's completely up in the air. You could make $5. You don't know. You have no idea. There's no stability when you don't know at least that baseline.
A study published this fall by the University of California at Berkeley found that these low wages aren't only impacting food service workers. They're costing the public more than $7 billion each year. More than half of these workers, including more than half of full-time workers, are disproportionately likely to need some form of public assistance for housing, healthcare, childcare, and food.
You know, the people who are serving you food on your plate, a lot of them can't afford to feed themselves. They can't afford to put food on their own plate. And so what happens is that the taxpayer has to subsidize essentially that low-road employer that wants to continue to pay people that $2.13.
Citing federal data, lawmakers backing the legislation to raise the tipped and non-tipped minimum wage say it would increase the salaries of more than 30 million workers and create 140,000 jobs over the next 3 years. An independent study by the Food Labor Research Center found that the bill would cause food restaurant prices to increase less than 1% per year. Members of the House and Senate plan to push for the bill's passage when they return to work in December. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Street art in the UK has helped regenerate poor areas, particularly in London. Many graffiti murals have been professionally commissioned, helping to transform rundown buildings into much more fashionable spaces. One of those involved in the UK's street art movement is a South African artist, known for his illegal art installations in the form of pastel-coloured mushrooms. Our reporter, Natalie Powell, went to meet him.
Christian Nagel is a South African artist living in London, but known in some circles by another name, the Mushroom Man. After accidentally stumbling on a technique whilst at home in South Africa, where he made a mushroom shape out of moulded expanding foam, Christian took the concept to London and began installing his mushrooms on the tops of derelict buildings and walls in the east of the capital. The mushrooms are painted pastel colours to fit in with Christian's pop art work, and though large, are lightweight so they can be easily lifted and installed, though, as he explains, not all of them are legally placed.
Mostly I've done illegal installation, unsolicited installations. I'd climb buildings late at night and sort of stick them on top of these buildings. My initial idea was for people to wake up one morning and go to work and then just see all these mushrooms sprouting about the street.
4 years after the birth of the mushrooms, he's now a full-time street artist, with his most expensive piece of art cast in bronze, fetching £12,000. That's around $19,000. And Christian's often appointed to install his mushrooms on the buildings of businesses in East London, those who want to be in keeping with the area and part of the movement. Street art and graffiti can now be found all over the east of the English capital. It's no longer a taboo subject, and many murals and works have actually been professionally commissioned. And a lot of the artists, like Christian, would argue that they've done a lot to regenerate what was once a fairly poor area.
I suppose street art's really helped with the regeneration of East London. You know, it's become a very hip place to be, to live. I mean, we've seen a lot of developments that's just moved in here, people building massive apartment blocks, modern buildings, and, you know, a lot of young money coming in here. And I think street art's had a big influence on that. You know, it's just made it a sought-after area.
But it isn't just London that these mushrooms have been popping up. Christian has taken his artwork all around the world, and even back home to South Africa, with plans for the next stop to be in South America.
I recently was in New York. I've done Berlin, Frankfurt, Spain. I've done most of Europe. I did about 8 in Cape Town last year, mostly along Long Street. And then I did about 4 in Johannesburg over a weekend recently.
Now considered something of value, street art is becoming more and more acceptable. But even so, Christian says his illegal guerrilla installations will continue, because as an artist, he's keen to keep pushing boundaries. Natalie Powell, London.
The World Health Organization has retracted a report in which it said about half of HIV cases in Greece were self-inflicted as a way to get state benefits. They say the inaccuracy was an editing error, but the claim was picked up on Twitter and was soon making negative headlines on news channels across the world. So what's been the reaction in Greece? FSN's Kate Fisher asked Greek journalist Anthi Karasava in Athens.
This was a top news story today, and it made headlines everywhere. But Greece has been in the headlines for the past 3 years. So it's ironic, and it sounds bizarre almost, but Greeks are now accustomed to these unfavorable and unsavory headlines. What is remarkable about the story, at least from the Greek perspective, is the lack of response from officials here. And more so today, in fact, one would have expected a more pronounced and intense play of this story and even a reaction by the officials as Parliament today discusses some very controversial sweeping austerity cuts, this time affecting the health sector and no doubt affecting these programs like drug rehabilitation. Officials, however, I've been speaking to at the Infectious Disease Center in Athens, which is the lead state-run authority on these issues, say that they have been unnerved by the inaccuracy of this report. They say that it does not reflect the present-day situation. They concede that, of course, the financial recession here has had an alarming effect on the situation. They said that there was a surge in HIV, in the rate of HIV infections by as much as 50% or over 50% in 2011 and 12, but that was, concerned drug users, and this happened because the government stopped funding drug rehabilitation programs, leading many drug addicts to, share needles. Since then, the government has tried to toughen up requirements for HIV carriers to receive this €700, about $900 a month stipend. And that, in turn, has led many HIV carriers to stop taking medication, exacerbating their health situation, and this for the sake of trying to retain that stipend. And faced with this alarming twist in this trend, these officials, these social workers, took to the streets again with whatever frugal resources they had, distributing syringes and condoms freely, and also conducting free testing on the streets. And that today, they say, has contributed to a 50% drop in the rate of infections of HIV. So that's why they are unnerved by this report.
Today, the OECD is saying that the Greek economy is to shrink again for the 7th year in a row. HIV funding is just one aspect, isn't it, of a society that is not going to have enough funds to do so many important things.
Well, that is the issue right now. We're 3 years into this financial crisis here, a financial crisis that has literally ripped through the social fiber of this country. And we're not just seeing HIV, rate infections fluctuating up and down. We're seeing a very alarming surge in the rate of suicides. The situation here, the financial crisis, has had just a rippling effect on society. Unemployment also is now at 27%, 60% among the youth. And that, of course, is creating additional problems. One of the other issues that, for example, the health measures today, which were being debated in Parliament, call for the closure of all mental asylums. What are thousands of people in these asylums going to be doing? There are, the officials are calling on their relatives, saying that you must come and pick them up by the 31st of December. Otherwise, they'll be left out there in the parks.
So the last thing that the country needs right now are negative, false headlines.
I don't think any country needs negative, false headlines. But again, this is not a headline that Greece would like to be seeing, and it's definitely not improving its image abroad as it's trying to lure investors and trying to spiff up its tarnished image and to show that it is trying to get its act together.
FSN's Kate Fisher talking to journalist Anthi Karasava in Athens. A new measure to encourage the teaching of the Swahili language in the schools in Uganda is making less progress than had been hoped for. Teachers say only a minority of students show any interest in learning Swahili, despite it being officially declared Uganda's second language. This despite concerted efforts to make it a common language in East Africa as the region deepens integration. Isabel Nakiria reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
We say that Nyumba imefanya nini?
In one of just a few Swahili classes in Uganda, the basics of the language are being taught. But student Gonza Raymond says it will take time to grasp.
Spellings of some words disturb us and some pronunciation of words disturb us.
The Swahili teacher Hadija Nantale concedes there is a general lack of interest in learning the language.
The students themselves feel shy to speak the language because they feel ashamed or they feel they don't have vocabulary, and because the Kiswahili part of our school is dominated by foreigners, they don't feel okay.
But lessons like these will be made compulsory in the next academic year. The East African community is moving towards better integration, and Swahili, which is widely spoken in the region, is being promoted as the unifying language. East African Community Commissioner Rona Sorada hopes Ugandans can overcome their historic doubts about learning it.
All the wrongdoers, the thieves, always spoke in Swahili. So the people, I think, didn't want to pick it because of that very reason. But I think we need to put that in the past and know that this is a language, it's a very good language, and it's going to help us as Ugandans to move and to do business with fellow East Africans.
Plans put forward by Uganda's government will require all children to learn Swahili at school. And while there are currently hundreds of local dialects in use, the government hopes it can help the region unite around one language. Isabel Nakiria in Kampala.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Thanksgiving special when we bring you some of the standout moments from FSN Reports. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great Thanksgiving. Goodbye.